Welcome to our briefing call. It will begin in a few minutes.
Welcome to the JCJ Lawyers Briefing. We still have people signing on to the call, so we're going to give them a couple minutes and we'll get started then. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the JCJ Lawyers Briefing. We're going to give people just two more minutes to sign on, and then we'll get started. Thanks for your patience. Okay, we're going to get started. Again, welcome everyone to the JCJ's briefing call. We're so glad you've joined us. It's a really wonderful demonstration of your commitment to civil rights and your desire to stay informed and involved. My name is Ariella. I'm one of three co-chairs of the Jewish Center for Justice's Lawyers Committee, along with Lisa Laffer and Patty Glaspie. And this is the first time the Lawyers Committee has held one of these telephonic briefings, but the response has been so positive, we'll probably continue to use this format to discuss legislative and judicial developments that come to our attention. I want to thank our co-sponsors first for this event, the Women Lawyers Association of Los Angeles and USC Law School's Outlaw Student Group for helping us get the word out about the call and about what's at stake in these cases. Most of all, I want to thank our speaker today, to whom I will hand over the call in just a moment. Aditi Fruitwala is a staff attorney at the ACLU of Southern California, and she works specifically in the organization's LGBTQ Gender and Reproductive Justice Project to advance the ACLU's work fighting gender discrimination, addressing discrimination against transgender and non-binary individuals, and improving the conditions and treatment of incarcerated women and LGBTQ individuals, among a whole bunch of other areas of focus. Aditi is a graduate of UC Berkeley's School of Law, and while there, she served as co-editor-in-chief of the Berkeley Journal of Gender, Law, and Justice. Not only that, but the ACLU is representing two of the plaintiffs in the cases we're going to discuss today, so we are very lucky to have Aditi here as our teacher and our guide to help us better understand the issues that are raised in the cases and how they might play out in the Supreme Court. Before we begin formally, I want to make sure everyone knows how they can ask a question during the call if they're interested. So if you think you may be, grab a pen or a keyboard now. All of the participant lines are muted. However, if you have a question that you'd like Aditi to address, you can either text the number 310-663-4252 or email your questions to rabbisimons@jewishcenterforjustice.org. We'll be collecting the questions, and then once Aditi has concluded the principal part of her presentation, we'll give her a chance to answer some of the questions that are submitted. So again, the phone number to submit a question by text is 310-663-4252, and the email address is rabbisimons@jewishcenterforjustice.org. So now, without further ado, Aditi, I'll hand the call over to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Ariella. I am so honored to be here today and get to talk to you all about this incredibly important seminal set of cases that are in front of the Supreme Court on Tuesday. I think one thing that's interesting about the way that we have talked about these cases and sort of attempted to raise awareness about them, one thing that we're coming up against is that most people already believe that federal law protects sexual orientation and gender identity in discrimination. And so really oftentimes when we're talking to people and talking to media, what we get is just confusion and shock that this doesn't already exist as affirmative protection. Explicitly including sexual orientation and gender identity. We believe that Title VII does already include protections for sexual orientation and gender identity, but not as explicit protections. Rather, it includes them as under their broad definition of sex. And so Title VII, which is the law at issue in all three of these cases, and I'm going to get to what the cases talk about and what's at issue in greater detail, but Title VII is part of the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964, and it prohibits discrimination on several enumerated bases, including sex, race, color, national origin, and religion. And so the argument being put forth in these cases is that discrimination on the basis of sex necessarily includes discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. And the employers in these cases are saying it does not include that, and employers should be free to discriminate against LGBTQ individuals because they're not explicitly protected under Title VII. So today I'm going to go over the three cases in front of the court and talk a little bit about what's what the legal issues are and the history of Title VII in relation to sex stereotyping, and so kind of the line of reasoning that got us here today, and then what some potential outcomes could be and how that's going to play out. And I want to end by talking a little bit about California specifically, because in California, as you can all imagine, our laws are actually much more protective than federal laws when it comes to sexual orientation and gender identity. That's true across the board, almost in any kind of bucket we can think of, but that's particularly true for employment discrimination. And so our California context is different than the federal context, but first I'll start off by talking about what's happening federally and what's at stake in these three cases in front of the Supreme Court. So the first case is entitled RG and GR Harris Funeral Homes versus Amy Stevens. And this is the case that's about discrimination on the basis of gender identity and gender expression. This is one of our cases. ACLU is handling it. And the background is that Amy Stevens worked as a funeral director at Harris Funeral Homes. She had been working there for 6 years. It's a funeral home outside of Detroit. And Amy had actually worked in funeral homes, that industry, for 20 years. She really enjoyed working in funeral services. She enjoyed serving people who are grieving and trying to help them in that difficult time. So, and throughout her 6 years as the director of this funeral home, she had received consistent positive feedback. And for anyone who practices employment law, you know that is an important distinction, an important fact when you're trying to figure out what discrimination happened and what type of facts you're going to marshal. So in this case, however, the discrimination was incredibly clear. There's really no question about why, what led to her being fired, because the employer was explicit about it. When Amy Stevens decided that she needed to start living openly as a woman, she's a transgender woman, she wrote her boss a letter saying, "I am a transgender woman and I will start dressing and expressing as a woman." And 2 weeks later, her boss fired her and stated that it would be unacceptable for her to appear and behave as a woman. So what's different about this than many other types of employment discrimination cases that we litigate, and I'm sure, any employment lawyer probably is facing a similar thing, but I have cases on pregnancy discrimination, on gender discrimination, on sexual harassment, and the employer is always attempting to prove that, the legally protected basis is not the reason for the discrimination. Here, they're not even attempting to assert that argument. Here they're saying, I fired Amy Stevens because she's transgender. That's the reason that I terminated her. And so the argument is not one of motive or lack of motive. It's just that Title VII is not meant to protect gender identity, gender expression, and largely you can fire transgender people without incident. And so the federal EEOC agreed with Amy Stevens, and she won at the lower court and the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit specifically held that the funeral home that fired her was prohibited from doing so under Title VII because firing someone for gender identity is firing them for sex stereotypes. And I'm going to get to that line of reasoning a little bit later. So that's the Amy Stevens case. The second case, which is also being handled by ACLU, is on behalf of Don Zarda. The case is called Altitude Express, Inc. versus Zarda. And this is a case about sexual orientation. So Don Zarda worked as a skydiving instructor at Altitude Express, which is a company in New York. It's located in Long Island. And he started skydiving as a hobby, and then he just loved it, and he fell into a career of skydiving. So at the time that the discrimination occurred, he had been skydiving for 20 years, and he was skydiving with someone in a tandem dive. He was skydiving with a customer, and he was chatting with the customer in the airplane before they jumped, and he mentioned that he's gay. And the customer complained to Don's employer, and Don was fired. So Don actually lost his case at the trial court, and the trial court said that his claim does not violate Title VII because Title VII does not apply to gay men. But he won his claim at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which found that discrimination based on sexual orientation is discrimination based on sex. And that's sort of the second line of reasoning that I want to talk about, which is like the textual argument of what we're talking about when we say because of sex. One thing to know about Don Zarda's case is, tragically, before his appeal, Don died in an accident. But this case is going forth by his surviving partner, Bill Moore, and his sister, Melissa Zarda. So this case is being continued on behalf of Don Zarda's estate. So the third case, which is actually not being handled by ACLU, it's being handled by a law firm, Buckley Beale, is called Bostock and Clayton County. Bostock versus Clayton County. The facts are that Gerald Lynn Bostock was fired from his job as a county child welfare services coordinator after his employer learned that he was gay. He lost at the lower court and at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court has accepted the case. And so we obviously have a circuit split. Some circuits are finding that Title VII covers sexual orientation, some aren't, and some are finding that Title VII covers gender identity, and some aren't. So the Supreme Court has consolidated these cases. They will be heard at the same time in the same oral argument on October 8th. So the central issue in these cases are, does Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination because of sex, apply to discrimination against transgender people and against lesbian, gay, bisexual people? So there's sort of two arguments that are being advanced by the ACLU, or two primary arguments. The first is the textual argument. It's just saying, and this is, you know, an unusual place for us to be. We don't often make these sorts of textual, just look to the letter of the law type of arguments. But in this case, we think that the law is pretty clear. The words because of sex apply broadly, and they include the people that are being discriminated in these three cases. And so for sexual orientation, the argument is, if you fire someone because of their attraction to the same sex, you're firing them because of sex. And the argument as it relates to gender identity is, if you fire someone because in your mind they changed sex, then you are firing someone because of sex. And I mean, essentially, the line of reasoning is that there's no way to explain why you don't like transgender people or why you don't like lesbian, gay, and bisexual people without using the word sex at some point in your explanation. If you're firing someone because you thought that they were a man and they're actually a woman, and that's the reason that's animating your firing, then intuitively that is on the basis of sex, right? Because changing sex is because of sex. So this is a legally conservative argument, because we're not actually asking the court to define what sex is. We don't all need to have the same like understanding of how sexual orientation operates and what that is, or how gender identity operates and what that is. So we're not asking the court to, you know, come up with some sort of like nuanced definition and test for what these terms are and how they operate. We're not asking for any of that. This is just a case that asks the court to identify the scope of discrimination because of sex. So it's a much more narrow project. We're just asking for a direct application of the words because of sex to sexual orientation and gender identity. So that's the first argument. The second argument is about sex stereotyping. The other thing that the federal law prohibits, Title VII prohibits, is discrimination because of sex stereotypes. And so, you know, when we're talking about gender identity, disagreeing with the notion of a transgender person is fundamentally because they don't meet your expectation of what a man is supposed to be or what a woman is supposed to be. And same with lesbian, gay, and bisexual people. Disagreeing with the notion of them and who they associate with means that they don't meet your expectation of who men and women are supposed to be intimate with. So I just want to get into a little bit of the background of Title VII for specifically for sex stereotyping and how that law has developed. And so Title VII, you know, it specifically for, you know, the Because of Sex Clause was intended to target cisgender, meaning non-trans, women's second-class status at work versus cisgender men. So, you know, in its initial conception, no one is arguing that LGBTQ people were considered when Because of Sex was added to Title VII, right? We have always been arguing that this is about what Because of Sex means, and how sexual orientation and gender identity have to be because of sex. But certainly in its initial formation, Because of Sex in Title VII did, you know, was applied to cisgender women in relation to their work status with cisgender men. But pretty early on, the Supreme Court kind of serially disapproved of rules that regarded sex stereotypes as required for employment. So in 1971, there was a case that was the first Title VII case in the Supreme Court, and it found that an employer's policy that refused to hire women who were mothers of small children, but they hired men who were fathers of small children, was discrimination on the basis of sex because it was based on the sex stereotype that mothers are, you know, the primary child care providers, and that makes them less reliable employees. And so the Supreme Court invalidated that policy under Title VII. A couple of years later, the court then invalidated an Alabama regulation that was a state regulation that required prison guards to be a certain height and a certain weight. And it was based on the assumption that bigger is better when it comes to law enforcement jobs. And that resulted in women's disproportionate exclusion from the applicant pool. And so that was Title VII saying it had a disparate treatment and disparate impact on women. And then there was a series of other Supreme Court cases that rejected certain policies that treated women kind of on their faces as different from men, such as providing pensions, providing, you know, increased pensions to men and increased benefits to men. So in the context of LGBTQ discrimination specifically, there are two really important strands of precedent. So the first is probably the seminal Title VII case that many people probably know about. It's called Hopkins versus Price Waterhouse. It was a case in the 1980s where Anne Hopkins sued the accounting firm Price Waterhouse when she was denied partnership, even though she had generated more business than all of the other candidates. There were 87 other candidates, all men, and she had generated more business than them, and someone else received the promotion. And candidly, she was told that the denial had nothing to do with her skills or her ability to do her job or her ability to get business. It had to do with the way that she presented. All of her partner reviews about her interviews said that she was too macho, she needed a course at charm school, and she was overly aggressive. And when she asked her mentor what she could do differently to try to increase her chances for a promotion the next time around, her mentor told her that she could walk more femininely, talk more femininely, dress more femininely, wear makeup, have her hair styled, and wear jewelry. So the Supreme Court ruled in Anne Hopkins' favor, and finding that she was denied partnership at Price Waterhouse because she did not look or act like a woman should look or act. And that type of sex stereotyping, making assumptions and having policies and practices about what certain women, what women should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing, was discrimination because of sex. So this is obviously incredibly important to our line of cases, arguing that discrimination on the basis of gender identity is discrimination on the basis of sex, because it's making assumptions about what women should be doing, what genital parts women should have, what type of clothing women should be wearing, et cetera. And on the basis of sexual orientation, it's discrimination on the basis of sex stereotyping, because it's assuming who women should be intimate with, who men should be intimate with, which is sex stereotyping. So the other pertinent precedent from Supreme Court landmark conclusions is that sexual harassment is discrimination because of sex. The term sexual harassment didn't exist in 1974 when Title VII was enacted. That term didn't even come into existence as a legal term until a decade later. But in 1986 was the first time that the Supreme Court recognized that conduct that subjects women to inferior terms, conditions, and privileges of employment was just as problematic and illegal under Title VII as a promotion denial or an unequal paycheck. And so they draw from cases that found that racial harassment and national origin harassment violated Title VII by poisoning the work environment of Black and brown people because of who they were. And they found that men's harassment of women could not have occurred if they weren't women. And so sexual harassment in the workplace was a violation of Title VII because sexual harassment was occurring because of sex. So that was in 1987. About a decade later, in 1998, Justin Antonin Scalia, who, as all of you know, has not generally been an LGBTQ advocate, led a majority of the justices in ruling that harassment did not actually need to be from a man against a woman to be considered sexual harassment. He ruled that harassment between same-sex individuals is also illegal under Title VII because that harassment also occurs because of sex. So, and you know, language in that decision is really helpful to us. The decision is called On Call, and he wrote, "The principal concern of legislators at the time of Title VII's enactment matters less than what the law actually says. Its protections often go beyond the principal evil to cover reasonably comparable evil." And so, I mean, even though Antonin Scalia was hostile to LGBTQ people in other realms of life, just in looking at what discrimination, just at looking at employment discrimination and seeing what discrimination between same-sex individuals, whether that could be considered illegal under Title VII, he said that the plain language of the statute compels that type of result. So years later, the EEOC essentially adopted that line of guidance, and it concluded that gender identity and sexual orientation are prohibited by Title VII's because of sex clause. So it was in 2012, the EEOC ruled in a case called Macy versus Holder that discrimination against a trans person because they are transgender is by definition based on sex. And 3 years later in Baldwin versus Fox, they found the same thing for on the basis of sexual orientation on behalf of a gay man. So other federal agencies like the Department of Health and Human Services have also made similar findings following the EEOC's lead on this. And as a result of these rulings, the EEOC, which is, you know, a federal agency that investigates employment discrimination, among other employment issues, as a result of these findings, the EEOC currently accepts, investigates, and attempts to resolve claims filed by LGBTQ employees across the country alleging discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity under Title VII. So, you know, to date, the federal agency is interpreting Title VII to include sexual orientation and gender identity and is accepting and investigating these types of claims. And the majority of the claims are coming from places that the states that don't have affirmative protections. And so we are, you know, what that data tells us is that people are experiencing high amounts of LGBTQ discrimination where there's not affirmative protections in their own states. So the opposition is essentially advancing two arguments. The first is that they're saying in 1964, when Title VII was enacted, there's just no way that Congress intended Title VII to apply to LGBTQ people. And, you know, of course that's true. You know, in 1964, same-sex intimacy was illegal in many states. Trans people were being prosecuted for crimes like impersonating a woman or cross-dressing. And so, you know, a trans LGBTQ existence was criminalized in several different ways and by several different methods. So, of course, you know, no one is arguing that Congress intended for Title VII to include LGBTQ people. But we're saying that that doesn't actually matter because we don't even need to get to legislative intent where the plain language of the statute is so clear. And, you know, Justice Scalia, who is not our progressive champion, has already advanced this theory in On Call when it came to discrimination on behalf or harassment among two people of the same sex. So the second argument that's being advanced is essentially playing on the fears of LGBTQ people and committing to enforcing just traditional gender norms. So the argument is that if we allow transgender and lesbian, gay, and bisexual people to be covered under Title VII, then it abolishes gender distinctions altogether. So this is concerning for two reasons. One, it's premised on a misunderstanding of what gender identity is, right? So, I mean, when a transgender person enters a sex-segregated space that's consistent with the gender identity that they are, the space remains sex-segregated. So if a transgender woman goes into a women's bathroom, that bathroom is still a women's bathroom. Only women are using that bathroom at that given time, right? But they're trying to enforce the idea that transgender people aren't who they really are, and it's just sort of a really classic anti-trans argument being advanced here, that trans people are committing fraud and that they're lying, that they're not who they are. So it's just, that is premised just on a misunderstanding and hostility towards trans existence. The second strand of this is grounded in a commitment to traditional gender norms. You know, what they're seeking is a world that is really kind of running counter to Title VII precedent on sex stereotyping. They're seeking a world where men and women function fundamentally differently and we treat them as fundamentally different in our employment laws. So they want to go back to a time where you can fire a man for being insufficiently masculine as long as you also fire a woman for being insufficiently feminine. This would really roll back the paradigm of all of the sex stereotyping law that's been promulgated under Title VII. And this implicates not just LGBTQ people, even though primarily that's the target here, but this would implicate anyone who wants to deviate from the framework of what, you know, their gender norm would be. And it would allow the employer to decide what is masculine enough and what is feminine enough. So it would, you know, it would permit policies like a heterosexual, traditionally masculine man who says, I have to leave at 5 p.m. because I need to go pick up my kid from school, it would permit an employer to say, well, men can't be responsible for child rearing in this way, so I'm going to fire you. And it would allow policies that essentially, you know, let employers dictate that you aren't the right kind of woman, you aren't the right kind of man, and I'm not going to hire you for those reasons. It could also mean that certain, you know, dress codes are enforced. Things like women have to wear skirts or lipstick or dye their hair. Men have to have, you know, closely cropped hair, and they can't wear an earring, et cetera. I mean, we can think of any gender stereotype that we've all been socialized with could suddenly become valid policies and reasons for in adverse employment action. So these seem like extreme examples, and maybe they are, and maybe in most cases they're not. Those aren't the type of policies that are going to be enforced. But it is the sort of thing that a traditional gender it is the traditional gender paradigm that they are attempting to make valid. And so this is the type of thing that their argument would permit. So as far as the outcome goes, Scalia did write a 9-0 opinion in On Call, in which we are basing some of our arguments on. And so we think, because we're advancing a textualist argument that's, done strategically in the hopes to get 1 to 2 of the conservative judges, maybe even 3, onto our side. We're trying to say that the legal arguments that we're presenting are incredibly straightforward. We don't actually have to even look at this very much. Just because of sex, we can take on the face of the statute. So as far as, what a win and what a loss could mean, a win would make it clear that, workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity is prohibited under Title VII. And I think that, that's just sort of clearly what the law would solidly, unassailably say. But I think what's important going forward is that these protections couldn't be taken away by future presidents and different EEOC commissioners, right? Because under Obama, that is what the EEOC said, and that is how employment discrimination law largely operated, because our federal agency had guidance and regulations that were protective of sexual orientation and gender identity. And so, the reason that this win is important, other than for the clients themselves, that it's also for future LGBTQ people, that their rights aren't just going to be based on the belief of future EEOC commissioners and future presidents. And this is, especially concerning right now, given that a number of the newly appointed EEOC commissioners appointed by Trump have expressed a desire to overturn past commission rulings that were on behalf of and in favor of LGBTQ people. The last thing that it would do is it would provide clear protection in the states that don't have affirmative LGBTQ protections under state law. So, presently it's 21 states, Puerto Rico, Guam, and D.C., that have affirmative state-level protections for workplace discrimination. So that means that half of the country's LGBTQ population does not live in a state that has affirmative protections. So that's what a win would look like and why that would be important. What a loss would look like is that it would mean that Title VII does not protect LGBTQ workers from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity or both. They could, of course, split the decision here because there are 2 cases that are about sexual orientation and 1 case that's about gender identity. So this would strip away existing federal protections from people, because remember that currently the EEOC sees sexual orientation and gender identity as encompassed in the Because of Sex clause. And so these are protections that people currently have. And this would be, we're not asking to be granted any additional protections. We're just looking to stay at the current status quo that's already been kind of enforced by the EEOC for quite a while now. Since 2012. So this would strip away those existing protections. And it would also mean that the number, that all these LGBTQ people who live in states that don't have their own protections would have nowhere else to go. We know that from 2020 to 2016, from 2012 to 2016, and 2012 was when the EEOC found that Title VII encompassed gender identity and sexual orientation. Most of the charges that have been filed on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, over 9,000 charges, were from states that don't have their own protections, right? And that's, of course, because there's nowhere else for those people to turn. They don't have They don't have other types of administrative options. And this would also just, you know, culturally, socially send a deeply disturbing message that LGBTQ people are legally inferior as workers in the U.S. This kind of, just to put it, like, to step away just for a minute and to put it into a larger context of what's happening, this is part of, you know, a larger plan to take away protections that impact LGBTQ people, not just from employment, but also in education and housing and healthcare. You know, this is a strategic plan to push out specifically transgender people out of public life. You know, on their face, these cases are about whether companies can legally fire someone for being LGBTQ, and that's concerning, problematic, and troubling enough. But on a deeper level, this is about what the definition of because of sex is. And that phrase is not only contained in Title VII, but it's contained in several federal statutes. And so, you know, we're looking to this, like, primarily for the Title VII and employment implications, but this could have pretty wide-reaching implications for other areas of our lives. You know, and so just a few to mention what the Trump administration has already done and the types of protections it's already rolled back for these populations. In healthcare, the Affordable Care Act, passed in 2010, prohibited discrimination on the basis of sex in healthcare in federally funded programs like Medicaid, insurance, healthcare facilities that received federal funding. And, you know, so it prohibited discrimination on the basis of sex. And in 2016, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services issued regulations saying sex includes gender identity, and thus discrimination on the basis of gender identity was prohibited. There was a rule promulgated earlier this year by the Trump administration in May 2019 that would remove that language prohibiting discrimination on the basis of gender identity, which essentially would suggest that insurance companies and healthcare providers could lawfully discriminate against people because they are transgender. And, you know, that these are all, this is all done by rules and regulations from administrative agencies. And so, you know, a Supreme Court ruling on what the definition of because of sex is would, of course, be used to either challenge or, you know, bolster these types of regulations and rules. So that's in healthcare. This also has implications in education. Title IX is the federal law that ensures equal access to education, and it currently prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex. And in 2016, the U.S. Department of Justice and Education released guidance stating that schools must treat a student's gender identity as the student's sex for the purpose of Title VII, including for school facilities and activities that are sex segregated. As you can guess, that guidance was rescinded by the Trump administration in 2017. And since then, multiple courts have held that Title IX's prohibition on discrimination based on sex does protect transgender students from discrimination, including discrimination by being forced to use sex-segregated facilities based on their sex assigned at birth rather than their gender identity. And so, you know, this guidance was rescinded. Several courts have reviewed and rejected the notion, and now we're being again asked to see what, and a reminder that this law is based on discrimination based on sex, and the guidance is about what based on sex means, and the guidance says that it doesn't mean gender identity, and so, you know, this could have implications in education as well. And the last sort of major area that is yet to come and we're watching closely and very concerned about is that the Department of Housing and Urban Development has also relied on various agency interpretations of sex to articulate the way that transgender people should be treated in sex-segregated facilities. So emergency shelters, like homeless shelters, are often sex-segregated. Oftentimes they only allow men or women. And kind of the same pattern emerges as has with healthcare and education, in that the Obama administration had regulations saying that you could not discriminate on the basis of gender identity in emergency shelters or any shelters that received federal funding. And the Trump administration has announced its intention to essentially rescind that guidance and those regulations and to permit discrimination on the basis of sex on the basis of gender identity in emergency shelters. That rule has not yet been promulgated. It's something that we're watching very closely, and we will certainly be responding when it is. But, you know, those are just honestly just a few of the places that because of sex appears in our federal law. Anywhere you could think that anti-discrimination protections would need to be in place has that enumerated list of saying, you know, race, religion, national origin, et cetera, and it includes sex. And very few places federally actually call out sexual orientation and gender identity as specific categories in the, you know, in the law itself. And it's really by regulation and rule that those protections have been expanded, which is why these cases are, you know, employment is sort of a broad and deep and important enough, but these cases are going to have far wider reach than just employment discrimination. So that's, you know, that's sort of the federal landscape. I just very briefly want to go over kind of what the states look like. So, you know, LGBTQ people in this country are sort of experiencing a patchwork of federal protections and state and local non-discrimination protections. And so, you know, your access and your protections, your anti-discrimination laws really depend on where you live. 52% of LGBTQ people live in a state that has some level of employment protection, and 48% live in states with no protections, and thus they rely on the federal protections that are given to them by Title VII. California, as you can imagine, is sort of a very very different situation than we're seeing federally. California has actually had these explicit protections for a very long time. It has, under what's called FEHA, the Federal Employment and Housing Act, California has standalone categories for sexual orientation and gender discrimination. And so California doesn't need to rely on the interpretation of because of sex, including sexual orientation and gender identity. Our statute actually has like enumerated categories for sexual orientation and gender identity just to kind of make it explicitly clear that that type of discrimination is prohibited here. And, you know, our progressive cities, this has been the case for a long time. I'm in Los Angeles. I think a lot of you on this call are also in Los Angeles. Los Angeles was actually the first city in the state to offer municipal employment protections against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. That law, that local ordinance, was passed in 1976. And at that point, it was only applicable to public employees, but 3 years later, it was expanded to include private employers. And so since 1979, discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation has been prohibited in the city of Los Angeles. In San Francisco, it has been prohibited since 1978, and that has been true statewide since the year 2000. Several bills were proposed before the year 2000 and were either vetoed or watered down by, you know, a series of our governors. But in the year 2000, the law was kind of concretized in the way that we know it today. And it applied to sexual orientation. And then in 2003, Governor Davis signed another law that extended those protections to gender identity. So in California, the landscape is very different. If you are discriminated against on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, that is just explicitly prohibited, and there's really no question about it. The questions that are kind of still live in California is what exactly discrimination looks like on the basis of particularly gender identity. I mean, you know, if someone is fired or demoted or denied certain accrual hours or something like that, then it's clear that that is an adverse employment action. The things that are sort of trickier that we are that we are currently litigating is the other types of adverse actions that can be taken, such as denial of certain restroom access, and, you know, that kind of thing. So that's not to say that, you know, the lives of LGBTQ employees in California are all rosy, but our laws have been developing in this direction for quite a while. And the, like, arguments and protections that we're fighting for are a lot narrower now because we have pretty broad protections. So for kind of the final thing I want to cover quickly, and so we can leave a couple minutes for questions, is what we can do in the instance, really kind of if we win or if we lose, that the answer is actually still the same. So the first thing that's going to be incredibly important in either scenario, but especially if these cases, if we lose these cases, is that the Equality Act at the federal level has to be passed. The Equality Act would provide comprehensive and express federal protections for LGBTQ people nationwide, including but not limited to employment. And so I'm bringing that up because I think, you know, in the instance that we lose, it's critical. Without the Equality Act, it's critical for employment, because without the Equality Act, LGBTQ people federally won't have those protections in employment. But even if we win, the Equality Act is actually broader than just employment. And so currently, federal law doesn't prohibit discrimination in public accommodations and federally funded programs it doesn't prohibit sex discrimination. So that's true for LGBTQ people and also for women. Currently, federally, a place of public accommodation, such as a restaurant, for example, can discriminate against LGBTQ people and women. They can say, we don't want this particular type of person here. Again, that's not true in California. California has broad protections on all of these enumerated bases in public accommodations. But federally, the Equality Act would cover all of these, you know, a variety of different identity groups in a lot of different spaces. And so it's important, sort of, whether we win or whether we lose. If we lose, it's obviously even more critically important. The second thing that we can do is that work to strengthen California protections. And so, you know, as I mentioned, you can't currently, it's clear that you can't do certain things against LGBTQ people in employment, such as you can't fire them, you can't demote them, et cetera, et cetera. But the other types of sort of more nuanced protections that people have, such as restroom access that matches someone's gender identity, those are still issues that are being fought out. And so strengthening those protections are what we can be doing locally and statewide. And then the last thing is so much more amorphous, but I think that I'm going to have to sort of mention it because this is part of a larger fight. You know, this is part of a culture change and narrative shift that's long-term and it's not easy. And we at the ACLU are actually investing resources to engage with that work as well, even though traditionally, you know, we focus on like these like large-scale litigation campaigns. But, you know, we are now investing time and resources to doing things like our national office made a short film about a young trans girl in Texas that recently won an Emmy, and we do a lot of work on social media and other types of traditional media outlets. And so things like that are, you know, for whether that's like at an organizational level or really an individual interpersonal level, having these conversations about inclusion of trans people and LGBT people is sort of that's the work that really moves things forward. So I think that's all I had. I hope we have a few minutes for questions.
Yeah, we do. We have about 7 minutes and about 3 questions. So I'm going to give you like 2 minutes with a lightning round.
Mm-hmm.
So the first question is from one of our participants asking, what is the best argument in opposition to the statutory argument you are articulating?
That's a great question. I mean, I think really the argument that's primarily being advanced is that this is just not what Title VII intended. And so, you know, the argument for what, because it's not what they intended, we shouldn't have to really contend with what a definition of sexual orientation and gender identity are. They're also trying to frame We are trying to frame this as like a pretty straightforward argument, like essentially just define gender identity, define sexual orientation. You can't do it without saying sex. And they're saying like that's kind of just semantics and linguistics. What gender identity and sexual orientation are like at a fundamental level is not the same as discrimination against women in the workplace.
That's helpful. Okay, thank you. One other question, and this should be hopefully a yes or no question, answer. Are federal employees who work in a state that's covered by protective state statutes entitled to those protections or governed by some other rules?
Yeah, that's a great question. So unfortunately, the answer is that if a federal employee who is, you know, like if the employer is a federal employer and the employee is a federal employee, and I know that that's like a maybe a nonsense way to answer that, but there are places that have some joint employment relationship. But if it's a clear federal employee, federal employer, it's governed by federal law. And we actually have a case where we have that sort of nuanced complication where the case is venued and in California, but it's in federal court and it's only dealing with federal employers and federal employees, and we are subject to Title VII, which is more restrictive.
Okay, thanks. And then final question. What weight do the previous decisions of the EEOC and other federal agencies that are favorable to the plaintiff's arguments in these cases carry with the court? And how does the federal government, how do those decisions complicate the federal government's position in their amicus brief? And the court has granted the Solicitor General leave to participate in oral argument, so they're taking up the cause of the employers. Does it undermine their legitimacy of their arguments or otherwise complicate their arguments to have all these federal agencies that have issued decisions that are supportive of the plaintiffs?
Yeah, so we're hoping that it does. You know, we are hoping that the fact that there's a slew of cases for the last 7 years from the EEOC that have both investigated and prosecuted discrimination on the basis of LGBTQ people. We are hoping that gets deference, as it should under, you know, Chevron deference rules of agency deference to its own regulations and own interpretations of the statutes that implicate it. And so we are hoping that it does. This is such a strange orientation to be dealing with these oral arguments because, you know, the EEOC is actually the agency that initially prosecuted Amy Stevens' case before, in conjunction with us. And so it was on our side for a very long time through this litigation. And now to be kind of at odds with the federal government is really strange and kind of underscores why these, like, standardized uniform protections across federal agencies and across the nation are really important because this type of kind of patchwork, depending on whoever is patchwork and like changing protections depending on whoever is in charge, whoever happens to be the commissioner of the EEOC or happens to be president, is just like not obviously inequitable, but also just not sustainable for employment matters.
And do you think that Gorsuch, having joined the court and his position on Chevron deference, will influence that and will have influenced any of the other justices in the meantime?
Yeah, so we are very concerned about that, which is why we don't think that we really have a likely scenario of getting all of the justices and haven't prioritized that as a strategy. We're really just hoping for kind of textual fidelity from one to two of the conservative justices to get us there.
Makes sense. Well, thank you so much, Aditi. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And we'll be doing more of these, as I said at the outset of the call. So we look forward to sending out information about other briefings, and we hope you'll join us again.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
All right. Goodbye, everyone. Have a great weekend.
Bye. You too.